Blog Talk Radio.
Leave a message for mailbox number 17202218500. Record your message at the tone. When you are finished recording, press pound. To cancel, press star.
We want to welcome everybody to Africa on the Move. That's right, Africa on the Move. We'd like to welcome you to a special program. We are doing tonight. We're doing a special program because this is a special situation. And this situation calls for special attention. As you know, there's a saying that more things change, the more they remain the same. And when we look at what's going on today around the world as it relates to African people and people who are oppressed, this particular statement has a very particular unique feature. When you look at today's society, particularly in the borders of the U.S. in terms of how this society and its institutions are dealing with African people. And what we're going to do today is discuss a new form of oppression. And this new form of oppression, we're talking about the new 21st century. 21st century high-tech lynching. When African people first arrived on the shores, we were lynched, physically outright hung. Today, there seems to be a new form of lynching African people, particularly the youth of our youth today. So our theme tonight is 21st century high-tech lynching. And if you're not careful, it may be one person's son today and your son tomorrow. We're going to discuss this theme in the context of the case of the Michael Fulton case. And with us today right now, we have Sister Katie Fulton and Brother Haki. And later on, we'll be joined with another special guest. But until that time, we'll move forward. And we'd like to welcome Sister Kane and Brother Haki to welcome to Africa on the Move.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm here. Yes,
good,
sir.
Good. Well, Sister Katie, I think one of the things we want to discuss with our audience tonight is this question of the new form of high-tech lynching, particularly as it relates to our particular African youth. Now, I'd like you to give our people maybe a backdrop on this new form of how they are using high-tech, i.e., in this case, computers, to falsely accuse and incarcerate our youth and turn them into a cash cow. We know today for every youth that lock up today, they are making hundreds of thousands of dollars on a monthly basis on them. So, Sister Kayla, can you just start out, give us a backdrop on this particular theme and this question of the Michael Fulton case?
Michael Fulton is my son. And a year ago, Douglas County law enforcement officials came into my home with a pass key. There was no knock. I was in my nightgown, and they ordered me to leave my residence as a gun was pointed at my head. They said they were looking for my son. I told them my son was not home. They insisted that I wait outside while they search my residence, and they did. They searched every room, closet. They searched all of my personal belongings, my purse. And when they found that my son was really not home, that they needed to confiscate all of our computers. They took all of our computers. They took the computers, cell phone, cameras, cash, cards, anything that would connect us in the form of help, they took. I asked if I could have my medicine that was on the kitchen counter. They handed me my medicine outside with a glass of water. It was very cold, but I endured this because I knew I had done nothing wrong. After they confiscated our computers and all of our technology equipment, they told me that a second group of officers would be coming in, and I still could not come in my apartment. The second group of officers came from Arapahoe County.
You have 10 seconds left before recording terminates.
The second group of officers came from Arapahoe County. I asked them if they had a warrant. They told me they did not have a warrant.
To replay your message, press 1. To re-record your message, press 2. To mark this message urgent, press 3. To mark this message private, press 4. To send your message, press pound. To cancel, press star.
Hello?
Yeah, please.
To replay your message, press 1. To re-record your message, press 2. To mark this message urgent, press 3. To mark this message private, press 4. To send your message, press pound. To cancel, press star. To replay your message, press 1. To re-record your message, press 2. To mark this message urgent, press 3. To mark this message private, press 4. To send your message, press pound. To cancel, press star.
Looks like we have some problems right
Goodbye.
Now, Ms. Fulton. We're going to come back to it, but I do believe we have Brother Hackey on the line. Brother Hackey, one of the things we want to discuss, I know you've been very intimate on this particular case. Can you just give our people a general background in terms of why we are calling this the new 21st century high-tech lynching, how computers are being used today to entrap African youth?
Yeah, well, one of the problems in terms of this particular case is that this phenomenon of, individuals utilizing imagery to transfer it from their computer to someone else's computer has been going on for about 10 years now. It's one of these problems the IT companies of Verizon, Comcast, and so forth are very cognizant of, but because it's a $1.3 billion a year business, there's little desire to actually to innovate technology to block these criminals from engaging in this kind of illicit activity. But because they engage in this illicit activity, a lot of innocent people, particularly African youth, are finding themselves inside of prisons on charges in which it's very difficult to defend yourself against unless you've got deep, deep pockets, unless you have tremendous amount of money. Now, what I'm talking about specifically is, when I talk about imagery, I'm talking about, like, for instance, child porn. Typically what happens is that every child porn is a white male between 25 to 45 years of age. They're upper middle income, and they're very well organized. So groups like the NAMBLA, North American Man Boy Love Association, the Pedophiles United, there's a myriad of groups that exist out here, and they're very powerful people. These individuals, part of this group, when we talk about powerful, we're talking about really powerful people. We're talking about politicians. We're talking about corporate types. We're talking about professors. We talk about professional people in general, you know, who have access to lots of money. And as a consequence of having lots of money, they're able to buy the latest technology in terms of being able to transfer, you know, images from their computer and onto other computers, whereas other people don't know that these images exist on their computer. Now, keep in mind, when they do this kind of, when they put images on other people's computers, because you're unaware, doesn't mean that government is unaware. What happens is typically the federal government provides locales a tremendous amount of money, particularly to prevent computer crimes. And so what happens is they arbitrarily monitor computers. And if they find images on your computer, then what happens is that they would come to your house and they would begin evasive searches in terms of, you know, trying to gather information, you know, pertaining to child pornography. Now keep in mind, the people who are primarily responsible for doing this are very wealthy, they're very powerful. Those people, part of those organized groups that engage in this illicit activity, are never caught. It's always people who have nothing to do with this activity, but nonetheless, unfortunately, these images end up on the computer, unbeknownst to the individual. And there was a case recently in Connecticut, where a man was accused of having child pornography images on his computer. Well, in order to extricate himself from those charges, he had to pay in excess of $250,000. In terms of being that case. And why it's so expensive? Because in order to prove your innocence, you need forensic computer analysts to go through the hard drive to assess exactly how the images got on your computer, at what point they got on your computer, and where they emanated from, or at least in the area where it emanated from, maybe not precisely where it emanated from, because a lot of times the technology that these pedophiles use is so intricate, it's so complex. It's very difficult for a lot of analysts to even engage exactly where it came from. I mean, the technology is that deep. But it's a very expensive technology, but it's technology that exists. And if you have deep pockets, you can afford it. And just in terms of just in terms of the technology, one of the tools they use is called botnets, and they're they're able to literally load tens of thousands of files on your computer, without a problem at all. They load these on your computers. At some later point, when they want to retrieve the images, they just retrieve them from your computer, provided your computer's on. So needless to say, a lot of innocent people are caught up or ensnared in this unfortunate drama in terms of innocent people ending up in prison. Now keep in mind, the prosecutor is not necessarily committed to the truth. He's not necessarily committed to justice. His powers as a prosecutor is measured in terms of convictions. And so therefore, he's not particularly interested in the truth. All he needs is to see an image on your computer, and that's all he needs. He doesn't have to have a computer analyst to go into the computer, the hard drive, to assess exactly, where the images come from and how they got on your computer. I mean, He would if he was committed to justice. But most prosecutors in the country are not committed to justice. They're committed to convicting people. We got a vicious, very vicious system in this country going on called private prisons. And one of the things is that when these private prisons, and in particular you talk about the Corporation of America, the Corporation of America, CCA, you got people like this who set up shop in these states. And one of the things that they do when they set up shops, they particularly stipulate in the contract with the state that we want 100% occupancy in our prisons. And if you don't do that, then we have the right to sue you for failure of fiduciary responsibility. Now, this is absurd. They're telling the state that we don't care, by hook or crook, we want 100% these prisons filled to capacity. The states will in turn tell these people, okay, fine, we will do that. In turn, you as a private prison can change the rules to facilitate people spending long periods of time in prison by virtue of so-called prison infraction or breaking the rules. And the state also facilitates this process in terms of convicting particularly young African-American males, particularly with respect to drugs or possible possession of drugs, in terms of filling up these prisons. So it's a very vicious game that they play. Now, with these new computer crimes that are taking place, it makes it even more convenient for the government, state, that be the state or federal, to actually incarcerate large number of people, irrespective of whether or not they're guilty or not. And like I said before, they're not committed to the idea in terms of justice or fairness. They're committed to winning. Because this is an adversarial system that we're talking about, it's not about truth, it's not about justice. It's about winners and losers. And prosecutors are judged by how many cases they win. And most tend to be very unscrupulous people anyway, so therefore locking up innocent people, for most of them, it's not an issue. They do that all the time. And a lot of them have political aspirations in terms of climbing the ladder, and they want to do it at the expense of, in particular, young black males in terms of, on whatever charges they can fabricate, bring them into the criminal justice system, ultimately convicting them where they do long stretches of time in these private prisons. So this is essentially what's happening to the young Michael Fulton in terms of what happened to him. And he's a very intelligent young man. He's a master's degree at the University of Colorado. He's a very intelligent young man. And because he's so intelligent, he has a bright future ahead of him. One of the things that we have to understand is that, unfortunately, in society, a very racist society, you have people who would love nothing better than to derail the aspirations of young black men in terms of their desire to become doctors, lawyers, engineers, and so forth and so on. And so, therefore, this particular prosecutor, Chris Gallo, in Douglas County, Colorado, apparently see this as a golden opportunity to derail this young man's future because he has it going on. He's a very intelligent, very articulate, very bright young man. And no question about it that, that's his special incentive for the prosecution to go after him. So unless the family can come out with an enormous amount of money, then it's going to be very difficult for the family to defend themselves against these kind of charges. Like I said before, the technology that these criminals employ is so intricate, so complex, that you have to have a really reputable computer forensic analyst to be able to go into the hard drive and decipher exactly what happened. If they're that good, the technology is that good. And if you don't have these processes, then there's a real likelihood that you're going to end up in one of these private prisons. So this is the dilemma that Michael Fulton is facing in terms of, not just Michael Fulton, but all young black people facing. But keep in mind, and when you prosecute these cases, they're arbitrary. The prosecutors could seek to find the truth if they wanted to. But it's very discretionary. In this particular county, Justice County was a very conservative county in Colorado. Every indication is that based upon their own statistics, that they're very arbitrary in terms of who they go after and who they don't go after. So obviously in a place like this, only 1.3% of the population is African. And of course, that particular population is very vulnerable in terms of, you know, them coming after them for bogus charges. But it doesn't stop there in Douglas County, Colorado. It's also applicable to every African in this country because it can happen to anybody. And this is a very, very danger that people got to understand and wake up and understand what's going on and realize that these kind of crimes, though they could be, you know, prevented, there's no desire to prevent them simply because there is so much money involved in terms of, you know, pedophiles, these criminal types, you know, consuming, buying up large, you know, lots of technology, paying lots of money in terms of the technology. So this is a fundamental problem that we're facing in terms of this high-tech lynching that's taking place in the 21st century.
Before we go any further into the case, let's talk about a little bit about the background on where this case is taking place at. Based upon your research, can you give the people a general understanding of the nature of the state of Colorado in terms of its people, their socioeconomic conditions? And what I mean by that, I understand Colorado is not a state that is a population of wealthy people. Their average income is higher than most average states. Can you talk about just the backdrop of that in general?
Yeah, well, this particular county in Colorado, Douglas County, is a very exclusive, very wealthy community. It's overwhelmingly white. 90.6% of the population is white. 1.3% is African, and the remainder is Latino, Asians, and so forth. The average income in Douglas County is $101,963. So it's a very, very exclusive kind of community, very conservative kind of community. And unfortunately, when we talk about conservative, we really talk about conservative because information doesn't flow freely through a place like Colorado because the people in power got a vested interest in making sure that whole conservative character is protected. Much like southern states, there's a real opposition to people being exposed to real education. And as a consequence, those people in power do all they can via radio, TV, print, to make sure that certain information is not available for the people. So unfortunately, you end up with a population of people who are somehow illiterate in terms of their understanding of the world or their understanding in terms of, you know, what goes on in society. They pretty much believe whatever they're told by the government, and that is a real fallacy. When we talk about, you know, dispensation of real justice in a place like Colorado or the South, then we have to understand that money plays an inordinate part in terms of being able to secure justice. If you don't have money, then there's a real likelihood that, like so many other innocent people in prison, you become another statistic, another innocent person in prison, simply because you didn't have money to fight your case. One of the things, too, that we got to understand, that generally in this society, when we talk about public defenders, 80% of defendants charged with crimes are represented by public defenders. Let's be very clear on something. Public defenders, under no circumstances, are in a position to actually defend the client. They simply can't do it. Number one, the caseloads are too big. Secondly, they simply don't have the resources in terms of providing, you know, necessary resources for the client in terms of giving them the best possible defense. the best they can do is represent symbolism, in which they give the impression that, in fact, that you've been represented without, in reality, when you're not being represented. So this was a fundamental problem you got in a place like Douglas County. Now, in Douglas County, Colorado, now, the average pay for your public defender is about a little over $4,000 every 2 weeks. I'm sorry, $4,000 a month. That is what you get paid per month. So needless to say, when you break that down, you look at, you're not talking about a sizable amount of money. You're talking about a very minuscule amount of money. So therefore, you can't realistically expect this man to go in his pocket and use his minimum salary to go in his pocket and actually do the kind of thing or kind of investigation you need in terms of being a viable defense. It simply won't happen. So as a consequence, in particular places like Jefferson County, in particular places like in the South, you have all these young black men who are in prison simply because they don't have the necessary resources in terms of fighting their case. And this is the thing that's happening throughout the country. I shouldn't just say the South, but it's happening throughout the country. And with these computer crimes, it's simply making much more easier for them to facilitate the wholesale incarceration rates of young African American men. And so this is the fundamental danger that we're talking about. So in Douglas County, they're talking about, now when I talked earlier about the importance of computer forensic analysts, now generally these people, if they're any good, want to require at least $250 an hour. Now, the Public Defender's Office in Douglas County is only talking about providing $100 an hour. Now, this is well below the market rate in terms of quality computer forensic analysts. So what that means is that if you can't come up with the money, then essentially then you're screwed. I mean, that's essentially what this is all about. Now, I'm sure that the Public Defender Office can make exceptions, in terms of really making a case, that in pursuit of justice, that you can't let monetary constraints get in the way in terms of providing real justice for people. They can make that case. But like I said before, because the representative of the poor, because these guys don't have large resources, and because they are judged in terms of how well they play ball, with the state, then it's not likely they're going to push for more expenditures to make sure that he gets a quality computer forensic analyst. Keep in mind, the public defenders are dependent upon the state for their livelihood. The last thing you want to do is bite the hand that feeds you, which means that you're only going to advocate so much for your client because if you alienate or anger the people in position to provide you clients, then they simply cut off the full clients to you, which means, you make no money. Even though you have a salary. But what this means is that by limiting the number of clients that you have, you're essentially saying that the defender is no good and you're building a case to get rid of him. And they understand that. And so therefore, they're not going to make any waves. And so this is a fundamental problem we're facing in Douglas County in terms of what's going on with Michael Fulton's case. And this is not just in Colorado, as I said before, but happening throughout the country. And it's incumbent upon people to wake up and understand that this is very real and that hopefully nobody will one day wake up and find himself in a similar constraint where some police officers knock on the door come get them for some alleged crime that occurred and which people are totally oblivious to. So this is a real problem in terms of the criminal justice system, in terms of its negative impact on the masses of African people, not only in Douglas County, Colorado, but throughout the country.
When we talk about serving justice for people in general and this whole concept of fairness, it seems very difficult that when you have to make a choice between your individual economic prosperity versus serving justice, there seem to be a large degree of lawyers who have put their emphasis on economic prosperity. Can you speak to the question of just based upon your research or trying to inquire your lawyer to help this young brother, some of the things you ran across in terms of lawyers not willing to take on the case because there was no real financial money to be made, or they made their services so expensive that justice could never be properly represented.
You know, one of the things that we really have to understand in society, and we don't understand fully, but we have to understand the role of class. We like to believe that people go to school, to law school, because they want their help. We like to believe that doctors go to medical school because they want their help. But the bottom line is that that's not necessarily true. That in fact, what weighs heavily on their mind is, you know, monetary concerns. The vision is that, well, if I went to school for a long period of time, I expect to be compensated. The whole point of going to school is that I want to be rich. That is fine. But in terms of just the overall function of society, anytime you have institutions that doesn't serve the interests of the citizens, then inevitably it leads to decay and chaos. And so this is a fundamental problem in terms of people who, you know, go to law school, but who refuses to help people under unjust circumstances, refuses to help them in terms of, defending the case. In this particular case, we've been in contact with a lot of lawyers. The parent, Katie Fulton, has been in contact with a lot of parents, as well as the current legal, Margarita Stokes. And I've been in contact with a lot of lawyers. And unfortunately, one of the first things they say in terms of taking the case is that they want huge, large sums of money. So the issue in terms of, injustice, the concerns in terms of atrocities being committed, the concerns of innocent people going to prison is not a concern of theirs. And you've got to wonder, what kind of person is it knowing that these kind of atrocities exist? Knowing innocent people are incarcerated for computer crimes which they're not responsible for, knowing that public defenders force young men, particularly young African American men, young poor men, to take a plea when they're innocent simply because they don't have resources, you begin to wonder, so what kind of system is this? What kind of system is this? In a country where you have 2.5 million people in prison, in a country where you have over 5 million people currently under auspices of probation and parole, then it seems to me that this issue in terms of finance, this issue of monetary concern, is a very real one. Because keep in mind, you can't divorce the criminal justice system from the general economic system that exists. By locking up large number of people, there are real economic savings to the state. Because a lot of the things, a lot of the clothes that we wear, a lot of the furniture that we use, a lot of the technology that we use, is created in prisons. The state can purchase prison work at a very cheap rate, so there's savings to be had from prison labor. And this harkens back to earlier time in terms of when our ancestors were enslaved down, in the South during the colonial era. When African people were free, the so-called free people, they were often picked up and asked to produce a work permit. Well, they couldn't produce a work permit. They were incarcerated with the threat that in order for them to be released, you have to render your labor to someone. Some white person would have to have use of the labor, that you, in fact, were, again, a slave, and that the only use that you have in terms of the system, or to the welfare in particular, was your labor. So therefore, we'll release you only once we know that you'll be going back to the fields, to the plantations, to do backbreaking work from your pay. So the paradox is there in terms of this propensity, to utilize black people solely for their labor without any pay in return. The prison system is an extension of that. But to get back to this question in terms of lawyers and this whole propensity to talk money as opposed to justice, it's irony, because I think I'm hard pressed to understand that as a lawyer, when you know that innocent people are in prison, or innocent people potentially may end up in prison as a result of what's going on, with these computer crimes. That if mere fact it doesn't motivate you as a human being to take a stand in support of people who find themselves, you know, inflicted by injustice, then it doesn't speak well in terms of such behavior. And it certainly doesn't do well for the system. It really encourages this kind of mindset to say that it's not about deprivation of justice. It's all about the bottom line. I think for African people, poor people joining society, in a system that elevates monetary concerns or the justice, then you get the concern. As this economy continues to deteriorate, and keep in mind, the deterioration of the economy has something to do with poor people. It has something to do with poor African-American males. It has something to do with poor white people. The deterioration of society is a direct result of a very powerful and a just aggrieved average. Fail to take consideration that there are other ways, other policies they can implement in terms of making sure that people in society get what they need, proper education, proper housing, but including these kind of things, you can do a lot in terms of, you know, saving the economy from decay. But they're opted for power, and because power is so important to them, that they're willing to sacrifice really tens of millions of citizens in the country, undermine the economy, so the poor with a large group of people, in particular African-American men, becomes indispensable. They have to do it. They don't have a choice. Because they create a society in which, you know, you got too many people which you don't need. And all the system maintains is longevity. All the system maintains is equilibrium. It's got to incarcerate a large number of people. The only thing different in incarceration in terms of, you know, getting rid of people, the only other option is to petition, in which you find other kind of way to kill off people, whether it be through diseases, whether it be through stress, whether it be lack of nutrition, in which you kill people off slowly. But the point is that people have to be killed off, and this is the direct result of people in power who change power over the good of the country, or the good of the citizens. And so therefore, when you have this mentality, this capitalist mentality, you got to understand that in a person with a mindset that is capable of doing almost anything, everything and everything is good. If they can't use you, they don't have a new form. So even if the justice is just a light in front of their eyes, they could justify in their mind, why if you can't pay $100,000, why you should yourself to go to prison? So the people mindset between the Catholic mindset, and as the Catholic mindset sweeps the country, as more people are caught up in the criminal justice system, you know, there are very small to actually out here people to clean up for the rights of people when they are unfairly criminalized by the criminal justice system. The only noise I know is in terms of really take a stand in terms of helping people who are indigent against unrighteous charges is one, the late field counselor, currently Ron Kubiak, Leonard Hines, sometimes Elton Manor. And that's all I can say about him.
Thank you, Brother Tariq Warren.
And Tariq Warren. So that's about six people.
And
for willing to do what is right in terms of the pursuit of justice. It doesn't speak well in terms of the mindset of these so-called lawyers.
Of course, we don't leave out Sister Sophia Elijah. We know she's also one of those who have and continue to do that. But I think what we're trying to do tonight, welcome to Africa on your Moon. That's your host, Brother Africa. We are talking about 21st century lynching. A new form of lynching, and you know, it can happen to your son. We're talking about this special case in Colorado dealing with Michael Fulton. And next 5 to 10 minutes, we'll be opening up our phone line. But we'd like to have our listening audience give their views and comments, not only about this case, but how we can avoid this from happening to us if possible. What we're doing right now with Brother Haki, who is an advocate and a researcher around this particular case, we're trying to lay out some specifics of this dynamic of this case, and we hope that we can compel the public to come forward to help this brother and sister who is in need. Not only is he in need, but I think the long-term aspects of it, I think your brother Haki alluded to, is we got to really look at the whole system in general. We have to transform, revolutionize, and change the essence of the system. But a continuous case, and like we said, we'll be taking phone calls in the next 10 minutes. We'll ask our listening audience to be patient and make sure that you dial 323-679-0841. And when you dial in and you want to have a question or comment, you must hit 1. Please hit 1 if you have a question or a comment that you would like to speak to. So let's continue, Brother Hackey. In terms of this case around Michael Fulton case, I also find this case of Vivian Strange because they had 2 jurisdictions that charged him based with the same crime. You had Douglas County and Arapahoe. Would you like to speak to that particular situation? What is your take on that situation?
Yeah, well, you know, again, the question in terms of money is a pivotal one in terms of understanding, you know, two jurisdictions pursuing the same case. In fact, Mother Katie Fulton alluded to the fact that not only was she visited by Douglas County officials, but she was also visited by Arapahoe police officials who came to her home. It's unusual in terms of you know, two jurisdictions, but for a case like this to actually come to your home. So it speaks to economics. I think one thing we have to understand is that there's a tremendous amount of money, you know, pouring from the federal government. So a lot of the things that the city governments are doing, they're doing at the behest of the federal government, because the federal government wants to do that. The question is why the federal government wants to do that. Well, it wants to create a climate of fear. It wants to create a climate of intimidation by utilizing the law enforcement to do that. And so the way they do that is to change policy with respect to you know, how police operate and to provide large sums of money for them. Recently, they had various articles talking about the militarization of the police, in which they have the body armor and the helmets and the high-powered weapons and grenades and all these things. But that's all geared toward intimidation. And that's precisely what the federal government wants to do. And so as long as these locales, these cities and these states and these counties, as long as they continue to abide by the rules or the regulations set forth by the federal government, then they are sure of making money coming into the district. And so their motivation is one of money. And so, therefore, you know, Michael Fulton doesn't just represent, you know, quote-unquote, an alleged suspect. He represents money. And so, therefore, you know, it doesn't matter that they come into each other's jurisdiction, because what they're doing is creating a case in terms of statistically, writing down that at least, you know, this is a viable suspect, and in fact that they're doing a job. And so for them, it represents money. It has nothing to do with justice. It has to do with money. As a matter of fact, one of the irony is that when they do that, you know, when you take resources to go into other people's counties, you know, to do the exact same things that the other county is doing, then normally when you talk about waste, then you got to believe or got to understand that it's extremely wasteful for you have a duplication of quote-unquote services in terms of rendering by the police, when one jurisdiction could facilitate a raid of someone's home without necessarily having another jurisdiction to do the exact same thing. It makes no sense at all. But it does make sense in the sense that when you talk about intimidation and we talk about money, it's important that we understand this. And so one of the things that when we talk about the criminal justice system, you know, when we talk about the pursuit of money, laws are constantly changing. And unfortunately, the laws are changing at such a rapid pace that many people are unaware of the kind of changes that take place. But the changes in laws are geared toward making sure more people can be charged, so it becomes easier to charge more people. The result is more money for this jurisdiction in terms of incarceration rates. And this is a fundamental problem that we're having in terms of that. Now, he got a case coming up in September in one county. Now, after his case in this county, he had to go to another county for the exact same charges. Again, this duplication, this waste of resources, one has to wonder Why would you do that? Obviously, there are monetary benefits in terms of duplicating charges. So this is the problem that we're confronted with. It's all about money, and it's not about justice.
Okay, not only is it all about money, but I think it's also about due process. When I say due process, based upon your research, can you speak to our audience about the difficulty that Ms. Fulton and her son, Aima, her court-appointed lawyer, is having in terms of trying to get information on the charges that he's being accused of? Most of the information they have on him, from my understanding, Brother Hackey, is that they're saying that legally they are not allowed to show them the information because it threatens the particular victims. But how can you defend something where you don't know what you're being charged of?
Yeah, well, you know, the whole point is that, you know, in criminal trials, we talk about the discovery phase. The whole point of the discovery phase is to actually to assess what kind of information you have, you know, present that information, you know, to the defense lawyer so they can prepare an adequate case. In the case of computer crimes, one of the things that you have to have access to the hard drive. In the Michael Fulton case, the prosecutor, Chris Gallo, refuses to make the hard drive available for examination. Instead, what he wants to do is to give them a disk. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out the disk. It's not going to tell you anything in terms of, what's really happening, what's really going on with respect to the hard drive. But in denying the family access to the hard drive, it makes it possible for them to present a case. And that's the whole point. Without access to the hard drive, they can't present a case, which means that the favor falls to the prosecutor. And that's what it's all about. So I think this particular prosecutor, apparently, you know, because he hears the International Crime Against Children Unit there in Douglas County, my guess is that he has political aspirations in terms of moving on up. So certainly there's a conflict of interest in terms of, as a prosecutor, leading the International Crimes Against Children Unit. So therefore, it's in his interest to deny the defense, to the extent possible, any access to any information at all. Now, this particular prosecutor said the reason why he can't make the hard drive available is because he feels that it would be like re-victimizing the kids all over again. Well, now, it's sort of an absurd argument. I mean, the point is that when we talk about images, we're not talking about real people. Certainly, we're not talking about something that has a consciousness. We're talking about images. Images in which the kids, alleged kids on the hard drive, are totally unaware of. So this notion that you're re-victimizing the kids is a policy that was written into law to justify, to make it very difficult for people to gain access to the hard drive. So when you talk about due process, people have to understand, due process is something that sounds good indeed, but in practice, due process for the most part doesn't exist. Unfortunately, and I hope that there are people who are there listening don't find themselves in a predicament where they have to involve themselves in the criminal justice system, or they have to go up against the criminal justice system and begin to find out that this whole notion of due process, in terms of that the government would follow certain rules, are no longer applicable to people who are charged with crimes in society. You have to understand that when we talk about people not having access, you know, to real justice, I think the thing we have to understand is that at this stage of history, and what's important that people understand is that we're at a fascist stage in history. And so the question is, what is fascism? Well, very simply, some people call it corporatism, in which corporations run and rule everything. But even more so, one of the things you have to understand, aside from the corporate power that exists in fascism, is also, you know, their ability to run things. So for all intents and purposes, the government no longer functions, that the corporations run the shots. To the extent government exists, corporations tell them what to do and how to do it. all the laws, all the policies, whether it be economic or otherwise, social or otherwise, are dictated by corporations and not by law. So the issue in terms of voting, in terms of, you know, your representation, has never really been real. But even now with fascism, it makes it very clear to people that this notion in terms of one man, one vote, that in fact it was a representative democracy, was all a sham. It never existed historically. It never existed in reality. So now with the advent of fascism in America, it's very, very clear. So hopefully people don't find themselves in, you know, involved in the criminal justice system where they're going to see that due process, in fact, doesn't work. So with Michael Fulton King's, you know, it's very, very clear that there's no due process. And the question is that who do you appeal to when your fundamental rights in terms of constitutional rights are violated? Who do you go to? Well, unfortunately, to a large extent, due process applies to those who have money. If you have enough money, you have enough deep pockets, you can intimidate prosecutors in doing what's right because he's too afraid that you may come back and sue him. If you don't have deep pockets, they're not threatened at all. There's nothing you can do to them. They can violate the Constitution. They can violate the laws. They can do pretty much whatever they want to do. They don't have to provide even a semblance of due process. They can simply do what they want to do. And so this is the problem that Michael Fulton is facing in terms of due process. This prosecutor, Chris Gallo, has no intentions in terms of you know, trying to be fair, objective, and honest about the prosecution of this case. So this is the problem that we're confronted with in terms of, you know, due process.
Only to speak about due process and to add to that particular point. Also, Brother Hackney, based upon my understanding of the case, we heard earlier the mother's, Sister Katie Fulton, and we had some technical difficulties in which she had to leave the program, and hopefully we have her on at a later date. But understanding her particular case, when it first arrived to her home, one of the things the policeman did was that not only did they put a gun against her head and kept her outside of her home for hours at a time, but they did it without a legal warrant. They confiscated all her properties inside of her home without a warrant. They took items that had no relationship to the case. Why was there a need for them to take money from her pocketbook? Why was there a need for them to take her personal phone? You know, how do you prosecute a case based upon the gross injustices, just the process alone? And these are just some of the things that has happened that people need to recognize. So you are absolutely right about this question of due process. It reminded me the other night we were speaking with a professor at a program. He said something about what you alluded to in terms of whether or not if this country is in now prison in a fascist state, where he stated that facts no longer matter. People know the facts. People know the truth, but they are determined to say what they want to say and stick by it. So I find this to be real important because what they do to one today, they may do to another one tomorrow, which may be you. So this is why it's an issue important to the listening audience and the population in general, is that the things that are going on with Michael Fulton case today can and will be the same things that may happen to your child. Do you agree with that assessment, Brother Hakeem?
Absolutely right. But you know, when they broke into Ms. Fulton's house, one of the things that we have to understand is that, you know, part of the intimidation, part of the humanization, you know, quote unquote suspects, is strategically planned. They do that for a particular reason. One of the things that we have to understand that when they come to your house, they come with it under the impetus that, in fact, that you are guilty. Even before you go to trial, the assumption is that you are, in fact, guilty. So if, in fact, you're guilty, then the kind of invective, the kind of verbal abuse that you're subjected to, it becomes commonplace in terms of law enforcement. And this kind of behavior is particularly acute when you talk about, you know, poor communities or people of color. It's particularly heinous. So when they put the guns to her head, that was simply to humiliate her. I mean, they knew clearly that she represented no threat to her. She was in her nightgown. She represented no threat. You know, she wasn't resistant. you know, she complied. She did everything they expected, but they just wanted to let them know, you know, that in fact that not only do they have the power, but in fact that our presumption is that you are guilty, so therefore we're going to treat you like a criminal even prior to a court case. So this is unfortunate, but this is just the way it goes in terms of the criminal justice system. One of the things, you know, we have to understand when we talk about the militarization of police department, we have to understand implicit in militarization of police department, what the police are saying to you is that essentially what they're saying is that the citizens are enemies. Enemies, then, you know, when you approach them, you don't approach them in a manner in which you work for the citizenry. You approach them in a manner in which they are, in fact, the enemies of the state. And so, therefore, you know, it's an adversary relationship. And this is kind of mindset that's been inculcated in law enforcement throughout the country. And this is why when they raid a house, why even situations where gunplay is not necessary, they immediately point guns at you, set to intimidate, to demean you, you know, to dehumanize you. And this is exactly what happened. And this is exactly what happened to Katie Fulton at home. Now, the confiscation of her money, of her cell phones, you know, even though she herself is not a suspect, they took those things belonging to her. And there is no real justification for doing it except to say they can do it simply because they can do it. There is no legal justification for doing it. There's no way you can explain taking her belonging somehow becomes a point of contention in a trial when the son is the one who's in fact on trial. So what relevance would her money or her cell phone or her purse, what relevance would it have in terms of the trial as it pertains to her son? None whatsoever. It's irrelevant. It couldn't even be brought up in a court of law because it's irrelevant. But for law enforcement, it's not about the overall function of the judicial. They have a specific role to play, and that is to terrorize the community. And this is exactly what's happening. And so when we talk about this militarization of police, and we talk about these, breaking into people's homes, you know, pointing guns at them, and we talk about, throwing bombs, into homes. I mean, it's unconscionable. Here, recently in Chicago, there was a case where a young 3-year-old was sleeping in the living room, and they threw a flash grenade into the house. They were there, of course, they were at the wrong house, but anyway, they were at the house under presumption. That somehow that they wanted the father for drug dealing. Well, it was the wrong house. But in their zeal in terms of getting their enemy to state, they threw a flash grenade into the house where 3-year-old was in the front room sleeping on the couch. Well, needless to say, the flash grenade did great damage to her. Consequently, the young girl, the 3-year-old, died as a result of that. Now. Well, the problem is that you would think that under circumstances somebody would go to prison in terms of criminal neglect, but that doesn't happen. A lot of these police officers are well protected by the system because it does the system's dirty work, and so when it does dirty things, the system tends to protect it. And so even the case like in San Francisco, we had Oscar Grant, where the police officer had him handcuffed on the ground, shot him in the back of the head. He only did 6 months in prison, or actually 6 months in jail. The fact that these guys, the building of the system, and as a consequence, well protected. And so, but to go back to the case in terms of what they did in terms of taking those belongings from Ms. Fulton that had no relevance to the case, it's what they do. Anything to antagonize, to humiliate, to demean, to undermine humanity, they're going to do it. They're told to do it, and unfortunately, you've got a lot of people in law enforcement who are not particularly sensitive to the needs of the community, who thrive on power, and so therefore, when they're told to do something, they do it without thinking. They simply do it because they're told to do it. And so this is the kind of people that the law enforcement like to attract. In fact, one of the things that people who have high IQs are disqualified from being police officers. And the reason being, with a high IQ, there's a fear that you may question things, that when someone tells you to do something that you know is morally reprehensible, that you wouldn't do it. And so, therefore, that would create a problem in terms of the system, the law enforcement as a system. So, therefore, they prefer individuals who are not thinkers, individuals who are compulsive, individuals, you know, who concede everything to power, people who have no great self-image, who may be the best police officers. And so, therefore, as a consequence of having these kind of people, police officers, they're prone to do all kind of bad things and not even give it a second thought in terms of just how bad those things are. I mean, of course, there are exceptions. We have police officers who are conscious. They, now and then, they do sneak through. But for the most part, they don't last long in law enforcement because they realize that what they're doing is not about the dispensation of law or justice. But, in fact, they're part of a mercenary machine geared toward, you know, the victimization among the poor, among people of color, among those who are not able to fight back. So this is the fundamental problem when we talk about law enforcement.
Again, we're talking about the 21st century, high-tech lynching, the Michael Fulton case. To our listening audience, you are welcome to call in at 323-679-0841. When you call in, please hit 1. We will acknowledge your last 4 numbers. We can call the last 4 numbers of your phone. Interviews, comments you may have, we will recognize you. I believe we do have a caller on the line. We're going to bring in this caller. Caller with the last phone number 2686. Caller number 2686. Welcome to Africa on the Move. Your question or comment, please, caller.
Yeah.
Caller, you on the
line?
You're on the line. Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Your question or comment? Yes.
Yeah, this is Ilya Davis. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, brother. How you doing, Brother Davis?
Doing pretty good. I agree with a lot of this stuff because I read a lot in the paper about the harassment. I see it a lot in local areas. Even so, I think that we do have a collective social responsibility that we failed in from the 64 Civil Rights Movement relative to trading most of the economics that was going on in African-American communities to be able to get, you know, those city, state, and government jobs, positions across. You know where I'm going with that. Even so, today we are people that spend $1 trillion every year. We are actually considered consumers and employees. That's how we're looked at generally, the ones that do have a job. I believe that the elixir to the problem when it comes to having the funds and the capability to galvanize us together to be able to deal with the legal problems, poor, homeless problems, is that we have to become business people again. And I think that we should practice the cooperative experience of W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, Fannie Lou Hamer, relative to total nonprofit, starting with community, cooperative markets to replace these convenience stores that these new immigrants have in the low-income areas. That from my study, I found out that they are making a minimum of $1 million a year serving food desserts in places that's considered food deserts. So I just think that we got to think about that. We spend $1 trillion. It circulates our community less than 0.1 times. The Latinos, 6. Asians, 9. They can't even compute how many times the Caucasians. And if we don't see that as being a predicate problem when it comes to galvanizing our young, I'm telling you, we know all of the problems. We can articulate them. Even so, if we don't form a collective solution relative to how to end it based on money, we have the money to fund all of these defense funds like other people do. We'll be able to build our own communities and our own police forces where they will have to check at the gate before they come into our community. Once we start tapping into and recognize how important that $1 trillion is that we spend every year.
Okay, caller, I want you to stay on the line. I'll let my guest respond to your statement, and we'll let you respond back, and then we'll continue to move forward. Brother Hackey, your response to his statement. I think he's implying that part of the issues facing us when we talk about the criminal justice system, the way they treat us, is because we are economically don't have no economic clout. In other words, we don't have no power as a result of that. How do you deal with that? At least, what is your take on his analogy?
Yeah, well, I think theoretically, I think, but there's a point. I think having access to money, by stimulating business in the African community is desirable, and certainly it would go a great way in terms of doing the kind of things we need to do in terms of innovating solutions to the problems that we're confronted with. But here's the problem. What the brother proposing fundamentally implies that somehow we have a frame of reference, we have a historical as well as even an economic understanding of the world that we live in. I think for the most part we don't. One of the problems is that when we talk about business, one of the reasons why Africans who possess money won't invest in African community is in part because they have internalized to a certain extent this notion that money defines who they are. And so if money defines who they are, they're not going to share it. They're going to hoard it. They're going to keep it for themselves. The more money they have in their minds, the more somebody they are. You and I may understand that's ridiculous, but nonetheless, that is essentially how people operate. And whether or not we can get people to realize, begin to understand, or begin to question this notion that material things or money defines us as a human being, then I don't think we can have any movement in terms of trying to empower ourselves economically. This is a fundamental problem we have. One of the things that when you talk about which comes first, economics or politics, most people say economics, but that's not true. The problem is that if you put economics before the politics, even if I give every African in the community $1 million, it's going to end up right back to the same people who we perceive as our adversaries because we don't have an understanding in terms of how to utilize the money. So the politics have to come first. So therefore, I can get with brothers and sisters who have an understanding in terms of what has to be done with this money, then we get together and we can utilize the money to do kind of things to empower the community. One of the things you talk about, the tree we have, and which represents something like the eighth largest economy in the world, when you look at athletes and you look at entertainers, you look at the kind of money they have access to, the one fundamental thing they don't have is a political understanding of the world. When you look at Kobe Bryant and when he says stupid things like, because I'm black, don't mean that, I'm concerned about black issues. I mean, when you got athletes saying things like, or Michael Jordan saying, hell no, I won't invest, to use money to create institutions in the cities for these kids. Hell no, I ain't going to do it. I could afford it, but I'm not going to do it because it's not in my interest. So when you have this kind of mindset that's so prevalent among African masses, the question is what can we do in terms of reinvigorate, but I can't say reinvigorate, but what can we do to instill, to at least inculcate this strong desire in terms of utilizing the money to empower ourselves and particularly to save our children? Because one of the things I'm a strong advocate of, if a people is too damn cowardly to save his children, then that people don't deserve to exist on this planet. It's very, very simple. All the atrocities inflicted upon our young people and our unwillingness to stand up, to be men and women, for me is problematic. But it's indicative of a deeper problem, and that is in terms of to the extent that we have internalized the values of the society. So one of the things about in terms of being American, and one of the things I never call myself American, I'm an African. African what? African. That's it. I don't use the American part because I'm like Malcolm. I don't think that fighting and fussing and marching and agitating, to be part of, that says that I'm not a part of, that I don't, there's no way in the world I'm going to advocate to be a part of something that doesn't want me, something that across the board, economically, politically, and socially, which is diametrically opposed to my existence, that I'm an advocate to be a part of. To me, that's crazy. But that's me. But a lot of people do believe in this strongly. And I do understand the points that they make in terms of, well, our ancestors did a lot in terms of creating this country. No question about it. our people. It wasn't for our people. The only scientific technologies come from African brains. There's no question about that. We're not talking about labor. We're talking about scientific innovation. And in fact, one of the things that they did when they went to Africa, their ancestors, they took the best among the Africans there to bring them over here to build, because they knew how intelligent Africans were. So, but this question in terms of just how much we identify, you know, with America, how much we internalize the values of America, those particular values are not particularly predisposed to create an environment of self-empowerment. I just don't see that happening with our people. So the struggle for us is to try to create a mindset of our people in which we understand that the wealth exists. It's simply a question of understanding how the wealth can be used to help yourself, in particular to save your children. That, my brother, is another discussion. So how we can do that, that's up for debate, and we can discuss that all night.
Brother Davis, I'd like to respond back. I'd just like to add another point to this question of economics and the politics. I think Brother Hackey alluded to the issue of that people must have political understanding first and foremost of what they're doing and why they're doing. In terms of the position that you laid out, there's a very similar position that has occurred many times. And one of the most recent times, I will point out to the brother Yahweh Ben Yahweh, who was incarcerated in Florida for quite a long period of time. Now, as you look at how they went about building that organization, that movement, is that they chose the economic arena first and foremost and not really paid enough attention to the political development of their people and their communities. And what happened was, yes, they built a large amount of economic wealth, but what happened was when the government decided to move on them, they really had no supporters to support them because the people never knew them. And in the process, when they build their economic program, the people weren't really necessarily included in it. So he was so isolated. And that's why they was able to do the things they did to him. So I just think that, we got to look at this question of the politics or the education, political education first, before we talk about the economics. To put economics first, I think we'll continue to make your errors. But go ahead, brother, make your point, and we'll continue to move on.
Okay, yeah, I understand both sides, the history of both sides. But with Yahweh Ben Yahweh, you know, I would consider that to some degree sectarian economics. What I'm talking about is total nonprofit economics, like the Red Cross, whatever. I mean, that's the economics that I'm talking about, across the board in economics. And I've been studying politics here for a little while, and the thing that I found out is that people that I've already involved in economics, that already have that money, they aren't the ones that have to go down to City Hall and beg this or give that. They have what is called a consent agenda, where they are lobbyists. They have money to hire lobbyists that already go to them, and whatever their plan is, they consent to it before they even bring it to the public. So we can complain all we want to, but they've already consented to it. That's number one. Number two, the thing that I remember that all the way back from the days of African perspective is that Stokely Carmichael, formerly Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, he said, and it resonates in my mind, is that without money and economics, that relative to politics, that we would never have any power. That's what he said, that we would never have the power to do so. But understand also that the economics that I'm talking about is also grassroots in a way to galvanize young people, because I'm just talking about the convenience stores for now, with the new immigrants that's running those convenience stores and taking all the money out of the community. I'm involved on a daily basis in these project areas, and they are already ready to be able to support something that's going to generate money back into their community, because they're sick and tired of how these new immigrants are coming into the community, taking all of the money out and not giving any back. So, you know, I'm giving you a position. But by God's grace, I'm going to work like an ant daily to prove to you what I say.
Okay,
because I'm just to organize the young people.
Okay.
I mean, that's cool. That's cool. That's cool. But let me just point out something real quickly to you.
Mm-hmm.
Tanzania, with the Ujamaa experience in terms of collective economics, one thing that the people lacked, they didn't understand imperialism. They had no real understanding. Jews and Rory understood imperialism, but the people didn't understand the kind of forces that would come at them when they try that. As a consequence, that experiment was destroyed. So in the course of your work, when you're trying to do the things that you're trying to do, which are noble, but then understanding that you got to prepare the people to deeper understand in terms of the political reality that they're confronted with. Because if you are successful, they're going to come at you. And if the people don't understand what's coming at them and why things are happening the way they happen, then you're going to succumb to the pressures of those who want to undermine what you're doing. So you can't negate or you can't liquidate the need in terms of political awareness in terms of the situation. Now, in terms of Kwame Ture, I think you got a misunderstanding of what Kwame Ture was saying. He never said that. He never advocated that. But thanks for the call, though.
Okay.
Honey, my brother, we put you on hold, and if you have something to say later on, and we have some more time, we'd be more than happy to come back to you. Just hit number one.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, and I still... Okay.
All right, thank you. To our listening audience, you are listening to Africa on the Move. For those that have views and comments, feel free to hit 1 and dial 323-679-0841, hit number 1. We are talking about 21st century high-tech lynching. Today may be your son, tomorrow may be someone else. But we are dealing with a special case called the Michael Fulton case. What we are trying to do is make you, one, become aware of the case, two, become aware of certain conditions that this young brother is dealing with, how these conditions can be imposed on your child. We know today in the United States, this whole prison industrial complex system is a cash cow right now. They are making thousands and thousands of dollars on the youth today by incarcerating them. You know, any time where there are billions of dollars to be made, to this question of justice, will not raise his head. And this is what we think what's going on with Brother Michael, is that they see another young brother they can incarcerate and make money. It's not about justice. Now, Brother Haki, one of the things about computers today, they can be very positive tools if you understand them and know how to use them properly, but also they can become a weapon where you can create the worst nightmare. I think this is what has happened to Brother Michael. Can we talk a little bit about how viruses, how people can send viruses into computers where you're not aware of, and these viruses can cause all kind of havoc and put you in a position where you'd be very much compromised?
Well, as I alluded to before, the technology in terms of being able to transfer files from your computer to unsuspecting others' computers is well documented. I talk about the case in Connecticut where the young man spent $250,000 for defense in terms of proving, with the use of a computer forensic analyst, could prove that, in fact, those images weren't generated from him, but they came from outside. The technology exists. The stenographic software that they utilize is so intricate, so complex, that in terms of even assessing, you know how it works, even for a lot of computer analysts, forensic analysts, is extremely difficult to do. So only among the very brightest of the computer forensic analysts are able to discern exactly, you know, how those images got on the hard drive. This is how complex the software is in terms of being able to take images from your computer and put them on someone else's computer, but the other person is knowing that you infected their computer. So this kind of technology is real, and it exists. And another technology earlier I talked about, the botnets. I mean, literally, they can plant tens of thousands of files on your computer, tens of thousands of files on your computer without you even knowing that they're there. They can hide them. I mean, this is how intricate the technology is in terms of. And so, unfortunately, the people who are actually behind, the criminal enterprise that are actually behind, you know, doing this kind of thing, don't get caught. They don't go to jail. It's the innocent people who go to jail. Computers is a good thing, but it can be used for wrong. I'm sure many people out there have probably been victims of, a lot of people at least have probably been victims of computer fraud, where people tap into the checking account or the savings account or the banking account and steal money from them. or a situation where someone out of say Nigeria pretends that they're wealthy and they flim-flam somebody utilize the computer, where they give them information and they go into their account and clean it out. So computers are a very useful thing, but they can be used for a lot of wrong. And this is simply what happened in terms of the Michael Fulton case. This young man was caught up in a situation where, unfortunately, when they send these viruses out or these files out, I mean, they can land on anybody's computer. Even with the latest software, even if you got the latest software to protect against malware or viruses or whatever, these guys, the technology is so sophisticated, it can bypass. You know, it can even trick you into thinking that, in fact, your computer is doing one thing when, in fact, it's doing another thing. And so when you click on, let's say, when a computer message comes up and says that there's a driver that's not operating, click on here if you want us to correct it. And you click on it, and then you open the door for the malware, or you open the door for the stenography software to install all kind of files on your computer. So this is the problem that we're having in terms of computer crimes. And so, then, like I said before, it's not like the Verizon, Comcast, Southwest, these corporations are unaware of this problem. They're quite aware of the problem. As I said before, this is $1.3 billion a year. So they're not about to tamper with the process in terms of preventing this kind of technology from being used, to essentially incriminate innocent people. Because it's all about money. It's a capitalist society. It's not about right. It's not about wrong. It's not about right. It's about money. And this is the problem. So computers are being used for all kind of wrong. So this is a danger, and people have to understand that it can happen to anybody. Anybody. When they send those fraudulent files out from their computer, they don't have a particular computer address that they're going to send it to, IP address they're going to send it to. They just send it out. And they can retrieve it whenever they want. But when it goes out, it can affect any computer. And this is the danger that we're confronted with in terms of this computer crime. So people understand and become very alarmed in terms of this kind of propensity that exists among the criminal element when it comes to computer crimes.
Although individuals may not have that capacity to target a particular computer, it's my understanding, I think, for Snowden that politically computers can be used and can be targeted by the government to undermine certain individuals. Now, one of the things I want to allude to in terms of the Michael Fulton case that the public need to be aware about, part of this equation also is you must look at the history of his mother. His mother has a historical activist background, and more importantly, she recently has a discrimination suit against the state. Now, one of the days when she was in the court, they made a statement to her and made a reference or asked her was that her son with her. And less than 1 week later, he ended up being charged with something. Now, I'm saying that for historical purposes, we know a lot of time when you have lawsuits against the state, they use different kind of coercion to try to compromise you to drop your suit. And I'm wondering if that may be a possibility, as well as we also know in this case, Brother Ike, that the apartment owners, they have given keys to people to come into their apartment without them being aware of it many times. And real interesting that one of the workers who's been working there for over 10 years, who has been coming to her in and out of her apartment without her knowing it, about a day before the policeman came to confiscate her private properties, he disappeared. Him and his family all of a sudden they move out. So I'm saying, in terms of looking at some of the dynamics in this case, there are all kind of reasonable doubt around this question of Michael Innocent.
Yeah. Well, but to your earlier point in terms of, yes, the government they do identify specific computers from particular individuals, and they target them. And they install files to make sure they check everything that you check. So that does exist. But I don't mean to say when I talk about pedophiles sending out their files, in terms of encrypting these files, and that somehow that the technology doesn't exist to target specific computers, because the technology does exist to target specific computers, and the government does that all the time. And Snowden was very clear on that point in terms of you know, the FBI targeting people simply because of the statements that they make or what they stand for or even the kind of jobs that they do that they're targeted. So you're absolutely correct. So I don't mean to mislead anybody and imply that it can't be done. Of course, it's done all the time. In terms of Ms. Fulton, one of the things is that, you know, the right wing in this country, the very racist, the very conservative element that exists in this country, it always exists in this country. It existed during the period of the Klan, during the early 19th century, 1922, the 60s, and is well now. These people exist with this very racist mindset, and they don't forget. One of the things that, as a member of SNCC, S-N-C-C, she was part of an organization which was partly responsible for, you know, making people around the world focus in on America and look at America and see America what it is, to fundamentally get people to understand around the world that America is a racist society and that the notion of democracy is a bogus one and that democracy, for all intents and purposes, doesn't exist in America. SNCC was responsible for that in terms of holding up American institutions, in terms of just showing how bankrupt they were in terms of, you know, the professed desire for democracy on one hand, on the other hand, doing everything to undermine democracy. So SNCC was instrumental in terms of that whole process. And they never forgot that. And so the thing is that they have files on everybody in terms of, you know, who were part of those organizations. And so through the years, you can bet that they pretty much track Katie, and they know she was there, and they knew, you know, what she stood for. She knew her history, and so therefore she wasn't. As far as they were concerned, she is in fact the enemy of the state, because at one point in time in her life, she actually took a stand and became a part of a formation that was dedicated to fighting injustices in America. Now, superimposed upon that is the fact that you know, she's suing the state, and of course, states have all kinds of ways in terms of, you know, trying to coerce you into not pursuing, you know, civil charges, you know, civil remedy against them, of course. You know, and particularly when they violate your rights, you know, and they know they don't have a case, then they got to find some kind of way to encourage you, or strongly encourage you, not to pursue with civil remedies and in hopes that, you know, and by you that you will actually relent and not go forward in terms of your suit. But I think they said a mistake in the thing they're going to intimidate Ms. Fulton in terms of not pursuing with that civil suit, because as a matter of principle, she's going to proceed, and she realizes that that there is a real possibility, because she's going to proceed, that the pressure grows in terms of desire by the county, the Douglas County, to actually incarcerate her son as a kind of punishment for daring, you know, to take on the state. So it is, you know, it's not the case in and people might know H. Rob Brown. The current name is Jamil Alameen. As a matter of fact, one of the things that law enforcement, the FBI, told him many years ago, they said, it's been 30 years, but we're going to get you. And you know what? They did. They formed some charges. I mean, some bogus charges. I mean, Geronimo DeJega Pratt. There was a situation in California in which a man was thousands of miles away from the scene of the crime, and he was charged for killing the police officer, even though they knew he was 1,000 miles away. He was ultimately convicted and spent 27 years in prison. So this notion in terms of them coming back at you because of your political history is very, very real. And I'm not saying this to scare anybody or intimidate anybody, because the whole point is that it's important that people take a stand. You know, no matter what you think, you know, the bottom line is that as the situation deteriorated, we all become enemies of the state. Because one of the things, part of the whole notion in terms of National Defense Authorization Act, the Patriot Act 1 and 2, is all geared toward criminalizing speech. In other words, it's geared toward to make sure it scares the hell out of you. And scaring the hell out of you, they hope to chill free speech. And so they feel more atrocities can be committed by the government as long as people don't speak out. So it's incumbent upon people to speak out. I mean, fear is, it may be prevalent, but it shouldn't stop anybody from speaking out, which is true. Because you don't have any other options. because one thing for sure, when you don't speak out, you encourage the hand of the very, very racist, very reactionary element in the society who's hell-bent on maintaining power at any cost. Even if that means wiping out millions of people, then they're prepared to do it. Under the National Defense Authorization Act, if it means incarcerating millions of people, they are prepared to do it. So this is the problem that we're confronted with. And we got to some extent, we have become more politically mature and understand that because Barack Obama is in the White House doesn't mean that, in fact, that, you know, that democracy on any real level is going to be implemented, certainly not to the extent that the wishes of the people become the guide, you know, for our politicians to follow in terms of providing us with what we need, whether it be food, shelter, education, and so forth. That simply ain't going to happen. Barack Obama is pretty much, you know, he's part of the system. He was vetted just like all political leadership in this country. They're all vetted. Not a damn one is poor. Not a damn one is not connected. Not a damn one is going to stand up for the masses of people in society, particularly the African people in society. So with Obama, you may get a lot of speeches about black men being more responsible, but you won't get a damn thing about corporations being responsible. You won't get a damn thing about the high incarceration rate of African men, which is tantamount to genocide. In fact, one of the things in the UN, there were many people raising the claim that, in fact, with this high incarceration rate, it's tantamount to genocide against African people, and they're absolutely correct. If you incarcerate any other people at the rate that you incarcerate African people, it'd be an outcry. If you did that to white folks, proportionally to their population, it'd be a huge outcry. It wouldn't exist. It wouldn't happen. It only exists in the African community because our people we're disorganized. We don't understand what's going on. Or a lot of us are just simply scared under the guise that somehow if we speak out, we might lose our minimum wage job or a job making $10 an hour. So, you know, you've got no other choice but to stand up. You know, they can only do one or two things to you. They can only kill you or incarcerate you. Those are things they can do to you. If they kill you, you won't know anyway. If you're incarcerated, hey, you won't be the first person to be incarcerated standing up against an unjust system. So you don't have any choice. If you really care about your people, if you care about your children, then you got no other course but to speak up, but more importantly, you got to become organized.
Yeah, I think that point needs to be emphasized. The silent majority, or those who choose not to do anything, therefore they think that nothing will happen to them. I think they need to understand the reality in terms of even if they don't respond by their inactivity, they are increased in likelihood that they will be victimized. And that's what you're raising, they're saying. Is that correct, Brother Hakeem?
Exactly right. And I think Samuel Vett in his book, The Choice, he laid that out back in 68. He understood how capitalism works. He said that back in 68. The choices. You got no choice but to stand up. You can choose to be pragmatic, as they say, but pragmatism is not going to save you, you know, as society deteriorates. Because by virtue of just being in existence, you fundamentally pose a threat to the system, to the longevity of the system and the equilibrium of the system. So therefore, they got to do something with you. And they don't give a damn about how quiet you are or how pragmatic you are or how good of a citizen you are. Those concerns are not important to them. What they are concerned about is the preservation of power. That's what their primary concern is. And so therefore, being quiet, you know, all you do is empower them to do more injustice. And as the more you remain quiet, then the intensity, the level of the injustices inflicted upon African people is going to increase. It's exacerbate. It's not going to get better. So this is the irony. And so people, you know, you better wake up. You know, if you don't understand the economics in terms of what's going on, in terms of the changes that are taking place behind the scenes economically, then you better start. If you don't like economics, you better take an interest in economics and begin to understand exactly what's going on economically and how that imperils your future in the society. You better understand that.
You know, early in your presentation, for those who may have came on and listened to this program, you talk about economic costs of trying to receive justice. Can you just talk just a little bit, based upon your research again, in terms of right now, Brother Michael needs a lawyer. He needs a computer expert, analyst. And also, they need money just to survive because they have basically drained and milked this family completely. And one of the ways how they drain and milk a family is they put unusual stipulations on your child and cost you to have to pay for it. For example, Michael Fulton has never been in any trouble, has never violated any rules. The brother was on the way of becoming, he finished school majoring in math and engineering. He's on the way of becoming a teacher. Now, he never had any encounter with law enforcement. He never drunk, he never did drugs, but for some reason or another, it's so important to make him wear the bracelet. And each time he wear the bracelet, they had to pay like $50 a month. They had to pay the courts $50 a month for the bracelet. Each time they made him take urine tests every week, he had to pay $25, $75 for that. In other words, they became tools to financially drain a person. Financially, from my understanding, the minimum lawyer, you want a minimum of $20,000 and up. Now, financially, the question becomes, how can someone who comes from a family that's not rich and wealthy be able to get justice in terms of proper representation if it's based upon these kind of monies? And what I really want to talk to in terms of what is your actual finding, the kind of cost that it will require, you know, for this brother to get justice. At the same time, what has your outreach been and its response as it relates to African churches and trying to talk to people about this case? How responses or lack response have you received, and what can we do to try to change that?
Well, I think that the reality is that just in terms of being indigent, the reality is, you know, you can't realistically expect justice in the system as it currently exists. When I talk about 80% of the people being represented by public defenders, there's a tremendous amount of pressure exerted on defendants, you know, by the public defender lawyers to plead guilty, simply because they don't have the kind of resources, the kind of money that's needed in terms of mitigating the case to put on a strong defense. So the bottom line is that if you're poor, you're going to go to prison. Now, in terms of when you talk about all of these programs that exist in law enforcement to essentially impoverish you, it's done for two reasons. One, it's done to punish you. I mean, like I said earlier, I alluded earlier to the fact that you're essentially perceived as a criminal, even though you haven't been tried. And so, therefore, it's part and parcel in terms of, you know, making it as hard as possible for you by imposing additional costs, you know, to so-called defendant. I think all second reason, I think, is also it's a moneymaker. So we talk about the private prison system, industrial prison complex. We talk about that in terms of kind of money to generate. Now, we're talking about generating $6 billion a year. Now, that's a lot of money. But that money benefits the prison industrial complex. But law enforcement also has a need of money. Aside from the money coming from the federal government, the federal government has empowered states and locales to implement all kinds of laws in terms of bringing money into their coffers. So part of this putting these stipulations on defendants is in part and parcel of means in terms of raising money, you know, for law enforcement. So it's all about money. In the age of shrinking economy, you know, as the economy continues to deteriorate, more and more pressures on law enforcement to create, you know, creative ways in terms of draining people, you know, of their money. And so this is fundamental what's happening. Now, in terms of the pursuit of a lawyer, of course, as I explained earlier, you know, the cheapest lawyer actually that we talk to, they were talking about the retainer of $20,000, but they're talking about an excess of, you know, $125,000, $225,000, as high as $300,000 to take, you know, to defend the case. Now, the reality is that if you're indigent or poor, now, the reality is you just simply don't have that money. So it's a real conundrum for people who are poor who are charged with crimes in society. And we understand that, you know, because these prisons are for profit, then they would like nothing better than to incarcerate large number of African men just for the sole purpose of maximizing your profits at the expense, you know, of you know, injustice inflicted upon them. So this is the problem that we're having. Now, one of the things is that when we talk about raising funds in terms of for this case, one of the things is so unfortunate. You know, we've been talking to a lot of churches now, houses of salvation, that if anybody have an inversion to injustice, it would be churches. Well, we're finding that a lot of these churches are not predisposed to give much interest in terms of social justice. That's interesting. But when I think back to colonial period in terms of the origin of churches in America, one of the things that were very clear, one of the things that they propagated was the notion that church or religion could only be taught in a particular context. In other words, church priests would only teach their congregation, in particular their black congregation, that when it comes to Christianity, that Jesus expect you to suffer to be a good Christian. You suffer now, and you go to heaven later. It also taught, inculcated in a lot of people, that Christianity expect you to honor your master. In fact, part of being a good Christian is honoring your master. So, you know, you go along whatever justice exists. If he comes to sexually abuse a woman, then she should submit. If he comes to abuse a man with a whip, physically, that he should submit simply because it'd be good. That's the best course of action as a Christian. It also taught us not to deal with the reality that exists, or at least the political reality that exists, that freedom was defined in terms of your mind, that in terms of being truly liberated, it was in your mind. And so therefore things like food, shelter, education, those kind of things were not important to you, because being free meant that in your mind, one day you would go to heaven, that you were truly liberated. And so these kind of views were inculcated in our people over a long, long time. And unfortunately, these views have been reinforced, you know, in modern society. And a lot of people today, the most antagonistic people in terms of social justice, a lot of times you find in your churches. And you wonder, how is that so? Then it comes to the mindset, because a lot of them believe that to be a good Christian, that you should go along with whatever the government tells you to do. And they really believe that. They also believe that being free can only be achieved in your mind. In other words, when political people struggle for, when Martin Luther King talked about the right for people to have food, shelter, clothing, education, and so forth, many Christians will reject that premise because he's going outside the bound in which Christianity can no longer support. So Christianity is not in their mind designed to advocate for the powerless or for the hungry or for the dispossessed. Christianity is for making the individual feel good about themselves, knowing one day that they go to heaven. And so therefore the terms of food, shelter, clothing and education, those kind of things, those things are not really important. So if the government denies you those kind of things, you should accept it in terms of being a good Christian. It's unfortunate in the 21st century that mindset still exists in a lot of Christian churches. It's unfortunate. So when we look at the history in terms of Christianity and we look at the behavior of the people today, then we understand the correlation and we understand that long flow of history in which Christianity was used to deceive our people coming to fruition in terms of the kind of values, the kind of things that people in church say. So we understand that our people, a lot of people in our churches are deceived in terms of what really goes on and why things go on in their place in terms of bringing about a different paradigm, in terms of a better way of doing things in society in which those things that Jesus advocated in terms of fighting against the powerful, serving the needs of the poor, treating people with respect, that they fail to understand that those things are the kind of things that you have to fight to come to fruition and not acquiesce to those who are powerful or to a government which is corrupt and wrong, simply because to be a good Christian means that you should somehow go along with the corruption, go along with the injustice. So it's an unfortunate incident, but this is a problem we've been confronted with in terms of trying to raise money with the churches. And these have been some of the most people who's been most adamantly opposed to assisting Michael Fulton in terms of this particular case, which is so sad. But that's where we are in the 21st century.
Okay, we're going to let our audience know. You can call in at 323-679-0841. This is Africa on the Move. We are talking about 21st century High Tech Lynchy, the Michael Fulton case. We have a caller. We'll call off your last four number, and you can state your question or comment. I believe we have a caller. We have caller 1954. Caller 1954, do you have a question or comment you'd like to make? Okay, I don't think the caller have a question. We'll continue to move on. But again, if you have a question or comment, make sure you hit one. We are talking about the Michael Fulton case. But back here, we have about 15 minutes left. What we do want to do is to try to appeal to the public on some of the things they could do to help our brother Michael Fulton. Can you give us some ideas? What is that that you're looking at or we're looking at as a group who are supporting and advocating on his behalf? What can they do?
Okay. Hold on 1 second. I can tell you one of the things he's really in need of. He's really in need of monetary assistance. So that would be ideal if people could somehow assist him monetarily. And I don't have that address with me. We lost the mother earlier. She has that address
in terms of
what is in the money.
Let me do this. Let me stop you for a second. And we do have the information. We do have a caller who has something to say. Caller 1954. Caller 1954. Welcome to Africa on the Move. Your question or comment, caller 1954.
Thank you. How you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing?
All right. I'm James Tuck in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Hey, Brother Tuck. How you doing?
I'm all right. Just started listening and see where you guys are, see where you're going. You know, I just wish you were a little bit more organized, a little bit more focused, because it's called extraction. All they do is just take our money, you know, take our money. We can't afford justice in this country, you know. But not until we decide to organize in masses and start becoming a black man, nothing's going to happen. And that's where we are. We do too much talking, not enough organizing and action, and then planning for action. And I know it's hard, because most people are just struggling to make a living. Those are my comments.
Okay, Brother Tucker, we thank you very much. I'll let my guest tonight, my advocate, one of the advocates, respond to your statement. Brother Haki.
Well, I think we're very vigilant that the organization is the key in terms of, you know, confronting the problems that we're confronted with. But unfortunately, at this point in time, we can't liquidate the need in terms of at least clarifying what the issues are for those masses of people who don't understand clearly what the issues are. So the only way you can convey in terms of the kind of things that are going on, the only way you can convey the desperation in which our community is confronted with is by talk. That's the only way you can do it. Organization ultimately is what we headed toward, but don't dismiss talk simply because, you know, you can become impatient in terms of the conditions that infect our people. Clearly, I mean, there's a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, and it would be ideal if our people would begin to understand or come to understand just how this situation in society. But many of us don't. We don't understand. And so only recourse available to us is to continue to talk, to struggle to create organizations to combat a lot of these social ills that we're confronted with. So this is the thing I want to say in terms of talk. Because one of the things I'm afraid is that when I hear people say things like, we're just talking, we're not doing enough organizing, it assumes that people are not organizing. That's the first fallacy. And the second thing is that they talk. When Farrakhan speaks, people listen. When Dr. Umar Johnson speaks, people listen. When Angela Davis speaks, people listen. When Cynthia McKinney speaks, people listen. So talk is a pivotal part in terms of getting our people to clarify exactly what the issues are, what we have to do in terms of movement. So, but it's a process, and you got to become patient, and you got to be careful in terms of how we articulate our concerns in terms of, you know how we go about bringing about change in the society. So that's all I want to say to the caller.
My point is, hello.
Yeah, go ahead. Your last response.
My point is, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello.
Yes, we can hear you. Yes, we can.
I've been in this movement all my life for the most part. I lived in Colorado Springs for 40 years, and I understand what you're saying about talking and things like that, but there's got to be a call for action sometime, and not unless we're willing to take some action, nothing's going to happen. I mean, I hear people all the time, they pretend like I mean, I've been talking for years. People listen to me for years and years, and they ignore me, and they don't get involved, they don't participate. And then in the end, when their son or daughter become a victim of this racist system, they call me, and they want me to sacrifice my time and energy dealing with one case at a time. And that's very disturbing, not until these black leaders calling for action and a plan of action, take action, nothing's going to happen. I mean, you should lead by example. I mean, there's nothing wrong with talking. I mean, people talk all the time. And most importantly, these people many of them are getting paid. They get paid for what they do. They live on a different level than the average person. And the result, they're not willing to sacrifice in order to make things happen. I mean, I clearly understand what you're saying, but not until we hold the man accountability of those people out there talking. Farrakhan, I mean, he talked, but Farrakhan, he's not suffering like the people are in the ghetto. And a lot of other people are not suffering. I mean, they're not willing to come down to the level where the people are and help those people who really need help. And not until we decide, make a commitment, that we're going to organize and take some type of action, like Dr. King did with mass demonstration protests, and I know some of that is going on around the country, but we've got to come up with a plan of action and take action. And talking, time out for talking, but we continue to talk about the same problem over and over and over again, and there's no action. Because they do know. People do know because I've been a victim myself. I mean, I have such a soft heart and such a nice guy. You know, it's hard for me to say no when these individuals get in trouble and their parents come to me, that they talk about me, or, you know, as though I'm the bad guy in the community. Once their son or daughter become a victim, then they run to me and want me to sacrifice my time, money, and energy to get them out of jail.
Right. Okay, brother. Well, we'd like to thank you. We only have a few minutes left. Brother Hockey, quickly, we've got to get in at least two quick points. We've got less than 8 minutes. But we'd like to thank you, Brother Tucker.
In terms of action, I might show what he mean by action. You can't work in isolation. Being isolated, you can't ain't much you can do. So that's the first point. The second point is that I think that it's true that Farrakhan may get paid in terms, but he does lead organization and he does have members of the organization. And so those probably in terms of bringing about change in terms of getting people to actually move, they'll probably be more amenable to that idea than most people. So I think we have to be patient in terms of not become frustrated. I mean, I understand you're not the only person that's been involved in the thing for a long, long time. Me and this brother, or the brother who moderating the program, has also been doing this for over 30 years. So we're not new to the ball game. We've been doing this for a long, long time, and we do sacrifice. So that's all I have to say to that. Real quickly. Listen, I need people to email this prosecutor. The email address is cgallo, cgallo.da18.state.co.us. That's cgallo.da18.state.co.us. And also I need you to email this guy, Doug Burton. The first individual is Chris Gallo. The second individual is Doug Wilson. Doug Wilson. His email address is state.pubdef@coloradodefenders.us. That's state.pubdef@coloradodefenders.us. His name is Doug Wilson. He is the supervisor of the public defender. We need for the state to provide funds for this young man to get a forensic computer analyst. He has to have that. Without that, there's a real possibility this young man is going to be in prison. He's going to be in prison with a lot of other innocent people. And we need people to write emails to guys expressing concern in terms of what's going on and to make sure that money is available to get a forensic analyst, you know, to go over that hard drive.
Brother Hackey, real quickly, and to our listening audience, if you don't hear the entirety of this program, please go to our archive at www.blogtalkradio.com/Africa-on-the-move, and you can hear the entirety of this whole program. For those who may be online listening to us now, if you click over to or dial in on 323-679-0841, you will be able to continue to hear this program. We may go over a few minutes, but we want you to get this information. And this information is that One of the ways in which you can get more information and talk directly to the moms, you can write or you can email them at saveoursons2013@gmail.com, or you can call 720-499-5146. The 720-499-5146. They have set up a fund called Save Our Son Defense Fund, P.O. Box 58, Inglewood, California. Inglewood, Colorado, 80151. For those that like to send any kind of donation contributions, you can send it to Save Our Son Defense Fund at P.O. Box 58, Inglewood, Colorado, 80151. Or you can go to any local Wells Fargo bank under the same account, Save Our Son Funds, Inc. And the account number is 848-252-7028. The account number again is 848-252-7028 to help financially support Brother Michael in his case. We only have a few minutes left, Brother Haki. One thing that came up really interesting about this case, I think the audience need to know, is that for supporters who have came forward in terms of trying to help this young brother, for a sister named Margaret Stokes, we just learned that she has now been under some form of legal law enforcement harassment and threat. Can you talk a little bit about that, about this recent act against Sister Margaret Stokes as relates to this case for our audience?
Sister Margarita Stokes has experienced a similar situation that Katie Fulton was experienced. Namely, she's suing the state. At one point, about a year ago, she was arbitrarily arrested, and she was brutalized. And she was able to demonstrate by using their cameras that she wasn't resisting. That in fact, they brutalized her for no reason at all. And as a consequence, you know, she decided to sue them. So it looks like she's going to prevail in her lawsuit. The thing is that she's intimately involved in this case. And recently, last week, she did a big rally in terms of discussing this case. And the sister is very, very talented. She's been doing all kinds of things on computer in terms of enlightening the community in terms of this potential injustice. And apparently, she's become the law enforcement has become aware that the sister is involved, you know, in this situation. Now, I want to point out one thing real quick also, that because of the kind of work that we've been doing in terms of not only nationally but internationally, the local officials there in Douglas County are beginning to feel the heat in terms of, you know, the injustice that they're trying to inflict on young Michael Fulton. I think this is just one of their ways in terms of fighting back, and Margarita just happened to be convenient for them. I think in their mind they can kill two birds with one stone. I mean, one, they can try to undermine her civil suit, And secondly, maybe intimidate her into giving up, you know, this fight for Michael. But the sister assures us that she's not going to be intimidated. She's going to stand tall. She'll continue to advocate on behalf of Michael Fulton. And we respect and love her very much. And we'll be in contact with her. And we'll definitely be informing the world in terms of what happens to her. And we want everybody to know, you know, exactly what happens to her, because she is a warrior.
And on that note, to our listening audience, to our participants, our callers, we'd like to thank everybody for allowing us the opportunity to come to your homes tonight. This was a special edition on the 21st Century High Tech Lynching on the Michael Fulton case. Again, we're calling for your support. You can support them financially by sending a contribution to Save Our Son Defense Fund, P.O. Box 58, Inglewood, Colorado, 80151. Or you can go to any Wells Fargo bank and look and ask them for, you like to make a deposit to Save Our Son Defense Fund, Inc., account number 84825270028. If you'd like to have more information, you can reach them at saveoursons2013@gmail.com or call 720-499-5146. We make this appeal to you. Share the word with your friends, your family, and your network. And let's come to Michael Fulton Defense and save this young African youth. But as the brother said earlier, the best contribution we can make is form an organization and become proactive. Until next time, if you'd like to have more information, By the way, also a website will be produced in the next few days. If you'd like to know the website, you can email saveoursons2013@gmail.com, or you can write us at africaonthemove1@gmail.com. AfricaOnTheMove1@gmail.com, and we'll give you that website information and give you the update. Until next time, let's grab to go forward ever, backwards never, and we leave you with the song by Roy Ayers, Africa, Center of the World. Thank you. This has been Africa on the Move.
Zero, longitude zero, and by the Creator. Sesanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now we give you Africa, the center of the world.